You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Mike.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Adam, you and I go back quite a ways. Tell the listeners, though, who you are and why you're with us today.
Well, in a year, I'll be probably the most oddly credentialed tech that you'll see. I'm working on a Master of Public Health degree from Western Michigan University right now. My career goes back 11 years now, so I've been a technician now for 11 years. Started with the chain, then I moved into a compounding independent pharmacy role. And I know you, Mike, through KCPA, so I'm very involved with the Michigan Society of Pharmacy Technicians. I'm a board member for MPA for that.
And the KCPA, just for those that aren't from the area, is a Kent County Pharmacy Association or a subset of the State Association of Michigan.
Correct, yes. I left in October. I am now the Pharmacy Savings Program Manager for a very small company called Health Plan Advocate. We're located here in Grand Rapids.
Okay, now wait, back up here, Adam. You left where?
I left pharmacy, which was an independent compounding pharmacy.
I didn't know that. You left there for this new venture, and that's called what again? Pharmacy Savings?
So I'm a Pharmacy Savings Program Manager for Health Plan Advocate. The company itself services companies that determine that they want to self-fund their insurance. So I try to cut down the amount they spend on prescription drugs. And right now, that reality is in pharmacy benefit land, a health plan spends about 15 to 20% of its annual spend in prescription drugs alone. That trend is actually going to rise, especially now that we have the new gene therapies that are starting to show up. So Zolgensma, Yescarta, those medications cost millions of dollars, and we'll be looking at ways of trying to contain those costs as well. Most of my day is actually spent being a patient advocate in doing that role. So
wow. All right. So I'm following closely. The one thing I'm not sure I caught is you're helping businesses keep their prescription costs down.
Yes. And actually, I work both with the member and the health plan. So we actually, in some cases, I'm helping go get copay cards and maxing those copay cards out to help both the insurer and the insured. So in the case of brand name drugs, there are multiple mechanisms we can use to control the cost on those. I also help members find the lowest price pharmacy because I can see the varied MAC list. I have a little bit more insight into how the maximum allowed cost list works, and I can use that to contain the cost of prescription drugs as well.
So do the people have, when you mention copays, do the people have prescription insurance through somebody else in this program?
Yeah, so right now I'm working with 5 different pharmacy benefit managers to do this, and their relative third-party administrators. So in the insurance world, there's a third-party administrator I'm working with locally that would be like a Secure One, and you probably will never hear these companies in pharmacy, a Secure One, ASR, or even some of the labor unions. I have a couple of labor unions I do this with, too.
It almost sounded like you were doing individual stuff, or do you find the best plan for the business and then pick one of these places for a year or something?
What our program does is we actually tack on a tier to their existing formulary. So in order to save them money, we take their tiers and we add a tier onto their formulary that if a drug costs more than $400, my company gets involved in helping find copay assistance because we would give them this really high copay. It roughly works out to about half the cost of the drug. But if they agree to...
They being the...
The member.
The member.
The member.
Okay.
So if the member agrees to go out and use the manufacturer coupon, then we would help them out in copay land and make copay adjustments. So I have a little bit more latitude with the pharmacy benefit manager to help out with that. But I also help out when it comes to infused drugs too, because those are billed under the medical plan, and trying to help members realize that there are ways to save themselves and their plan money that way too.
All right. So I don't know if word's gotten around the city yet, Adam, but I'm kind of slow, so I got to back up on this a little bit. Was that the rumor at your pharmacy that Mike's kind of doesn't really have all his marbles upstairs? I'm not sure if that's a rumor going. No, I'm just kidding. All right, so the insurance is used, and we all know that what you want to be insured for is some of the higher price ones that could wipe somebody out with a cancer drug or something that's very expensive, but you want to be covered for that. So with these plans, when it hits $400, then the insurance doesn't cover it, and then you're allowed to go to the manufacturer and say, look, this person doesn't have coverage. What can you do so they can get this medicine?
Not so much that. The plan's still going to pay for it.
I see.
We're going to use whatever manufacturer assistance is out there.
I see.
Once you hit $400.
You allow the copay to raise up so that their copay card will cover more up to their limit and so on?
Correct. Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, because I know that my daughters are on some pretty expensive arthritis medicine, and if the insurance didn't cover it, or the insurance, I guess, could have raised their copay, and I think the manufacturer would have supported it. I don't know the exact details, but I know the expensive ones. It's like, if the manufacturer is out there, then let's raise it up to where we think they're going to help at what level.
Right, exactly. And we do a little bit, that's the bread and butter of the program. The other side of that equation is managing what runs through an infusion center or a outpatient infusion pharmacy. The other part of my program is finding patients the lowest cost place to get an infused drug as well. So when we talk about that, we're looking at chemotherapy, some of the new infused biologics for multiple sclerosis carry a pretty hefty price tag. Ocrevus, for example, which is infused once every 6 months, if you get it done in the wrong place, it'll run you about $101,000 a dose.
This sounds like more of a kind of a free market thing coming in. So like versus a regular insurance where it seems like I wouldn't have to shop the rates, and it seems like the price to the insurance would sort of be macked out. But in this case, it sounds like there's kind of shopping the most, let's not say the cheapest, but the most economically sound one. Why is there that play in that? And then how does it benefit the members again? Tell me that again.
Okay, so doing some price shopping, back in the day, and I kind of have to hit the rewind button until practically you began your pharmacy career, Mike.
we were on, my back always hurt because we were on stone tablets back then, but.
So if you hit the rewind button back, you know, when Blue Cross Blue Shield was probably first.
Yeah. Yeah, back
first
in the
thing.
Right.
You know, back 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah, mid-70s, I'm remembering, right.
Yeah. So Blue Cross Blue Shield came about, and they said, okay, hi, Dr. Smith. I've got 1 million covered lives. If you agree to take a 25% discount off of your bill, you can have access to all my members. And that's how the preferred provider organizations got started back in the 70s and 80s. And a lot of them still do that today. So many of them, even yet still today, are in the position where they go, okay, if you go to a hospital, we have a contract with the hospital and it's 25% off the bill. If you go to a doctor's office, we take half off the bill. And that's how a preferred provider organization works to contain the costs. And the challenge I have on the medical side is there's really no way to know what the cost of the bill is going to be ahead of time. In fact, you don't find out until about 14 days later after the claim's filed and paid. On the flip side of the equation, I can actually use a pharmacy benefit manager to bill the same drug and do it for less. So going back to that Ocrevus case, if I have a hospital bill the medication Ocrevus, and this is not an advertisement for Ocrevus by any stretch of the imagination, Ocrevus would run you every 6 months $101,000 a dose if a hospital were to bill it. I was able to convince the hospital that they needed to use their specialty pharmacy to bill it. So we put a stipulation on the coverage that said it had to go through the pharmacy benefit. The cost went from $101,000 to $32,000.
Gotcha. Because from my angle, I think the bigger pharmacy benefit managers, for better or for worse, have kind of had a take it or leave it value. They have a MAC price on it, where the hospital might say, well, yeah, here's a drug which doesn't have a MAC, and we're also going to throw in $50 for a Band-Aid and, you know, $100 for a ball of cotton and lunch and all that kind of stuff. Is that where that extra pricing, or at least they could say it was?
So here's a dirty little secret. Hospitals are allowed to make up their own price.
Yeah.
So in the hospital side of the equation, you can realistically write your own check. And typically what you will see is about a 300 to 500% markup on medications.
Some of those are maybe MAC'd at some point, but in the meantime, if they're a little bit obscure or new or something like that, there's maybe not a set going rate yet.
Well, there is. But there's 8 different pricing references you can use. And typically what you will see is whatever Medicare pays, multiply that by about 4 or 5.
Gotcha.
And that's what they bill a commercial insurance. And what you'll end up seeing is a hospital billing a medication that costs them $30,000, and they might bill it out at $102,000.
Right.
Dose. And then the preferred provider organization is going to come in and say, fine, we'll take 25% off that bill. But even then, off of a $101,000 drug,
right,
the claim's still going to be $77,000.
Right.
And in self-insurance land, that could actually throw you into what's called stop loss. You don't ever want a patient, I'm finding out very quickly in my new profession, you never want to land a patient in stop loss, because stop loss carriers never want to pay a claim.
Stop loss is the hey, we'll take care of all these things, but when you get into these higher ones, you're in a new stratosphere, and we've got a secondary insurance that's going to cover these higher ones, but they're very difficult to deal with.
They can be. So what happens is part of what my company does actually is the underwriting for stop loss carriers. But let's say it was your old pharmacy, Mike. K Pharmacy decides to go out and self-insure their own employees. And what the third party administrator would do is say, okay, you're on the hook for each of your members up to the first $40,000 in claims. 80 to 90% of your members are never going to hit that $40,000. Okay. But if you get a breast cancer patient, or you get a patient with multiple sclerosis, they're going to run over that $40,000 without even blinking an eyelash.
Yeah, right.
And what a stop loss carrier will do, they'll say, okay, well, for the first year, we'll pay that extra whatever it is. And let's say it's the $101,000 drug. So they'll pick up the other $61,000. But the following year, they're going to get hip to the fact that that patient's got $101,000 in claims. And they're going to come back on K Pharmacy and say, for that particular patient, you're going to be on the hook for $101,000 worth of medical bills.
Gotcha.
And I know what the cash flow of pharmacy is nowadays.
If you
ever had a patient or one of your own employees cost you $102,000, that's going to hurt hurt in the pocketbook quick.
Yeah.
So our goal is to actually prevent that from happening. And in this Ocrevus case, by billing the pharmacy benefit manager and then maximizing how manufacturer assistance on top of it.
Right.
I got the cost for a year of her medication down from $198,000 down to $58,000.
Wow. Wow. So...
so by changing some of the mechanisms, and pharmacy benefit managers, for as bad of a rap, I have a love-hate relationship with pharmacy benefit managers.
Yeah.
I know most of my pharmacy colleagues would go, I have a complete hate relationship with my pharmacy benefit managers.
Yeah.
I have a love-hate relationship with them because there's times where they're absolutely key to what I'm trying to do, and then there's times where they're working against what I'm trying to do.
Right. It sounds like there's some different terms that could be used. So when they talk about a business, one of your businesses being self-insured, it's like, well, it's you could call it self-insured, but actually it's a really, 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 really high copay. And then a separate insurance kicks in later. Are there any companies that actually that you know of, Adam, that fully self-insure? Like, let's say you have a company, you know, a huge company in town where they're going to be like totally self-insured. And if someone costs $10 million for a new transplant or something, they cover it all. Or do you think there's always that secondary thing in there?
So pretty much any employer that has more than 100 employees is more than likely self-insured because...
But totally, even for the catastrophic problem, or do you think they go somewhere else for that? To the
so the where you hit catastrophic coverage, where you set your stop loss is how much risk are you willing to take on as an organization?
Sure.
So if you are a larger organization, and by the way, stop loss, that's actually called a deductible. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking in the same terms, think of it as a deductible for your health insurance fund.
Sure, right.
Depending on how much risk your organization's willing to take on,
yeah,
will determine how much actual risk you have as an organization.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and probably the more people you have, the lower the chance of people getting this same condition or whatever. And that's one way, I guess, to do it.
If you're a larger organization, say you have 1,000 or so employees, the risk that you're going to have 15 to 20 type 2 diabetics is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
The risk that you're going to have somebody that's got rheumatoid arthritis is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sit there and probably have an epidemiologist sitting in your human resources department trying to figure out who's going to have what.
Yeah.
But in all reality, it's how much risk as an organization are you willing to take before your stop loss carrier picks up the bill.
Right.
And I've seen that number as low as 40,000, and I have two or three plans where that number's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the part that's under that, you have to essentially create a fund for. It's just like the escrow in your house.
Yeah.
You have to make that savings adjustment for your property taxes and your homeowner's insurance and whatever else have you. You have to plan for that for each of your employees and your health insurance fund too.
Yeah.
So if you have a bank account with $40,000 sitting in it to cover your healthcare expenses,
right,
the moment you trip over that $40,000 and that's where your stop loss carrier kicks in, your TPA is going to start sending that bill over to the stop loss carrier instead.
Yeah.
And then every year your plan gets reevaluated.
Sure.
And then that determines where your stop loss carrier is going to place your specific deductibles.
Yeah.
That's also going to determine which of your members, and this is called lasering, which of your members has a higher deductible. So the more you can save money on the front side, the less your stop loss carrier gets nervous.
Right.
And if you can put a patient in possibly large case management, but you don't send them all the way out to stop loss, the stop loss carrier doesn't view that as high of a risk
as would
if you were to flat out go and straight into stop loss and that was expected to continue for decades and years and years and years and years. Some of the side effects of being able to do work like this, I keep going back to the Ocrevus case because it, one, I'm on vacation this week, so I don't have all my stuff sitting in front of me.
Yeah.
And two, that one sticks straight out in my mind.
Sure.
One of the side effects I can do with doing this kind of work is because I shifted Jane Doe's Ocrevus from being billed as a hospital claim to being billed as a pharmacy claim.
Mm-hmm.
What she accumulated in out-of-pocket expenses actually goes down to, I think it was $520. She would have capped out her out-of-pocket expenses at $7,900 in one claim.
Yeah.
Otherwise. So.
Well, Adam, I told you I ain't no genius, but if you're going to pick an example of your work, you might as well stick with the one where you saved, you know, $70,000 and stay away from the examples where you maybe saved a buck or two. If I were you, I'd keep that story going.
I love that story.
I don't mean story as in an embellished fake story. I mean, it's a story, but it's an example, let's say, a real example.
It is truly a real example. And that's actually where health claim costs are actually going to be headed anyway. We look at our medical director and I have looked at what's coming out in the drug pipeline. And 75% of the new drugs that are coming out in the marketplace are going to have to be infused in a doctor's office.
Mm.
And almost every single one of those drugs is going to cost more than $10,000 per dose. Mm. So we are going to be watching those drugs extremely carefully because those are going to be drugs that are in oncology, multiple sclerosis, seeing a few new ones. There's a new one for HIV that's a biologic that's probably going to be horrifically expensive. The new ketamine nasal sprays that are coming out run about $7,900 a dose. They have to be administered twice a week. So the medications that we are looking at coming out in the very near future are going to cost health plans a very large amount of money. We're going to have to find creative ways to fund those expenses, especially on self-insured employers.
And unfortunately, it's got to be very creative, because if you take that to the end game, if you have if there's $1 million drug and you and I are still talking 7 years from now and you're still using your example of saving, you know, $60,000, that's good, but it's still, you know, a $940,000 drug. It's just going to wipe, you know, I don't know where it's all going to end.
It's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
Biosimilars are not coming out as fast as we want them to. So it's becoming extremely difficult to lower these costs. So one of the things I'm finding now is I'm making deals with hospitals and saying that they have to use their own specialty pharmacies to bill their medications and bill them through pharmacy benefit. And that's just to save the amount of money that I, the most amount of money I can.
Oh, they would not do it through the patients, but bill it through their own specialty one.
Right. So
see what they charge it at.
Yeah. The consolidation of healthcare is really making this difficult. So we're seeing a lot of, they call it vertical integration, but you now have Cigna owns Express Scripts, and you have several hospitals that are joining forces. Ascension is outright huge compared to the little, like, tiny hospital out in the middle of the sticks.
Yeah, right.
And they basically write their own prices, essentially. So the only way to keep them from doing that to your health plan is essentially making them use a reference-based price. So
pharmacies got stuck a long time ago on that. I'm not sure why the hospitals are so far behind. Maybe the doctors' groups are better, stronger than the pharmacist groups were.
The challenge we have with their systems are still circa 1975.
Yeah.
So
there being the hospitals?
The major medical systems in their entirety are still stuck in 1975.
Well, you wonder if they do that on purpose so that they're not able to, so it's like, they're able to have a little smoke and mirrors on the prices.
They do. And one of the things that strikes you as odd when you're working in major medical land is the sheer and simple fact that there are no NDCs on your claims. Hmm. So the National Drug Code doesn't exist on any one single claim. So I don't know if a hospital is billing for a regular drug, let's say a Humira, or its biosimilars.
And it's just a HCPCS code or a Medicare yeah. code of the diagnosis, but not an actual, this is the exact drug that we use.
So right now you have HCPCS, and HCPCS, some of them are designed to have biosimilars and some of them are not. Some of them are trainable to have the brand name versus the generic, but they are not required in many cases to send a national drug code along with the claim.
Jeez.
You have no idea what they're really billing.
Jeez.
And when people start complaining about getting surprise medical bills, this is where some of the surprises are coming from.
That's a term when there's mystery, there's margin, you know, when you don't know what it is, you don't know what it costs, or
right, especially
they can charge anything they want to.
Yeah, especially when you look, I was reading a study last week, the top 10 hospital CEOs and their salaries, and Ascension came up. Ascension owns four hospitals that I can think of off the top of my head in West Michigan, both of them in Muskegon, one of them in Grand Rapids, and one of them in Kalamazoo. Uh-huh. Their CEO makes $11 million a year.
Hmm.
And they own half of the Detroit hospitals too. So
yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of, that's a lot of, aspirin. Or maybe it's not a lot of aspirin. Maybe it's one pill the way that some hospitals bill it.
It's probably like, you know, half a dozen infusions of biologics, but.
Well, you know, the thing is going back when we talk about the early insurances of the of customers, when, as I remember, when Blue Cross started coming, and in the mid 80s when I was a little bit more involved, and then finally as a pharmacist in the 90s, before the time where you felt like these third parties were no longer on your side, we were trying to do these things in many cases, not to your extent of those things, but the attitude of pharmacists was there. It's like, hey, instead of doing a prescription for a 5 milligram and a 2.5 milligram tablet, where these both cost the same per tablet, that's sometimes how they price them for those listening, let's save everybody money and let's go with a 5 and then say take 1.5 tablet. And that's a small example of how pharmacists used to work. And now it's gotten so nasty out there that, you know, some people are like, screw it, I'm gonna do like the doctor wrote and do a 5 and a 2.5. And if I'm in kind of a cranky mood today, I might even do 3 2.5s, you know, or something like that. My point is that the tables have changed on pharmacists really giving a crap about a lot of these things because they've been treated so poorly by the PBMs. It's kind of a way to legally kind of give them a little punch back.
It is. And I've been slowly finding out in what I do for a living is that the larger your pharmacy chain is, the different kind of leverage you have. Mm-hmm. But if you're K pharmacy or even your PSAO, you still only have the negotiating power of maybe 2,000 or 3,000 pharmacies. Walgreens and the other chains, if you take the big three, for example, the big three chains in the United States, you're talking about one has 10,000 stores, one has 8,000 stores, and the next one down after that has about 6,000 stores. They can actually almost dictate to a PBM, especially a smaller PBM, what they want to get paid.
And we saw some pushback, though, with Walmart and who was it? Walmart and maybe Express Scripts this last year, and finally a few weeks later you see that Walmart says, yeah, they'll do it. I don't know, you never know where the, you're not in the room where it all happens, but you don't know where the who pushed and who accepted the push.
I see the fallout on it, and I can tell you who won. So generic Lipitor sticks out in my brain as a prime example of this. And I have seen claims come through for a penny to for the same 90-day supply costing $75. So
that's what they're being
that's what they're getting reimbursed from the PBM.
Yeah, because for those, I mean, I think it's all pharmacists mainly listening, but for those that don't know the system, it doesn't, unlike the hospitals, it doesn't matter what the pharmacist charged because they already have rules set up. They're saying you can charge whatever you want to. It's kind of like Henry Ford saying you can get whatever Model T color you want to as long as it's black. And so right. they can charge whatever they want to, but what you're saying is despite the charges, that the payments going back to them were a penny and then $75.
So yeah, depending on what size pharmacy you are, I'll take the penny claims out of that because that's really only one chain out of yeah, the dozens I work with.
Right.
But you would see generic Lipitor. It's generic Lipitor 20 milligrams, number 90. A number 90 claim for one particular PBM would be reimbursed at in a range between $9 and $75. Depending on which pharmacy was billing that.
Depending on which pharmacy, you know, that's...
I can tell you what the $9 pharmacy was, and I can tell you what the $75 pharmacy was.
Yeah, don't give me names, I think. I think it would bother me too much, but...
I will tell you the $9 one's an independent.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, and again, there's... It might be getting, you'd think it would be getting better with the internet and with maybe a more dissemination of the information and people being able to compare and stuff more, but that didn't seem to catch up as fast as the shenanigans were going on in the background with the PBMs.
Yeah, and I've been playing around with a business model, and I've actually seen a few dozen different pharmacies do this. I have been playing around with the concept of pharmacies turning into 501c3 organizations almost unilaterally.
Interesting. Basically being a charity, but then getting charity prices, but then paying themselves a salary.
Yeah, exactly. With that, you can still bill insurances. You would actually turn into like a federally qualified health center.
Right.
There are places that you can get free meds. So if you have patients who need the free meds, you can get them the free meds. That becomes your charitable purpose. And then you can still have a related for-profit entity that would then not be subject to income tax.
So the savings would be in the income tax, or the savings would be, and also it wouldn't necessarily change your rate with the PBMs by being a nonprofit, right?
No, you wouldn't. So you generally would essentially, you wouldn't have to pay corporate income tax. The only thing that makes a difference is when you go to dissolve the company at the end,
yeah,
all the assets of the organization have to go to a charitable purpose related to the way your articles of incorporation are written.
Yeah. Well, I don't need a lot of time for ideas. I'm not going to be around this planet too much longer. So, you know, if I have something that lasts a little bit of time, that's probably good. So Adam, personally then, how did you decide to make this move? Is this something that you kind of had in mind along with your, you know, master's in public health and things like that? Or?
Well, I started going to school for a master of public health. And the position that came up for me, the position I ended up taking, I already knew that as a pharmacy technician in a community pharmacy, my master of public health is probably not going to serve me very well.
No.
I mean, there's really not much I can do with it other than possibly going into diabetes education,
sure,
which is a thought that crossed my mind, but I'm still thinking about that. But in all reality, with a master of public health, staying in community pharmacy is probably not where I was going to land.
Sure.
The position that I ultimately have now came up I started interviewing for it last August, and it basically was, we want you to run our pharmacy savings program. The way it was incepted originally, it was just basically find manufacturers' coupons and apply them to the benefit of both the plan and the insurance and the member. Mm-hmm. It has since morphed into cost contain the entire pharmacy spend.
Sure. Well, you keep throwing around that damn $70,000 story, and they're your job description is going to go up.
Yeah, my job description certainly got a lot longer. I've learned a lot more in HCPCS coding now than I ever wanted to know.
In any way, has your technician degree and certification, has that been any benefit to you instead of a pharmacy degree? I mean, I know that the upfront was maybe a easier road, but are you finding any advantages in the corporate world of saying, I'm not a pharmacist? I'm not saying there is with the question. I'm just curious. Sometimes you get put into certain roles as in certain professions that maybe it's better sometimes not to be. Have you found any benefit of that?
In a job outlook standpoint, if you had asked me that question when I was graduating high school, I probably should have gone to pharmacy school back then. Now, I graduated high school in 1996.
Yeah.
Had I gone directly to Ferris State University right from there, I would have been the last possible admitted class that could have gotten a BS Pharm.
Gotcha.
So I would have been able to become a pharmacist in 4 years.
Yeah.
I went instead to teaching college.
I think at the time that would have been typically a 5-year process already, but you might have been able to speed it up for 4, right?
Yeah. So you probably would, it would have been a 5-year bachelor's. Realistically, even an education bachelor's was 5 to 6 years.
But I mean, pharmacy was officially 5 years then, but you could have taken summer classes in that to speed it up to 4. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So realistically, I could have been a pharmacist in 4 right out of high school.
Yeah.
When I finally got into pharmacy in 2009, it would have been PharmD only. In all reality, it didn't suit me then to go back to school to get my PharmD. The Master of Public Health, though, has opened my eyes to a whole whopping world.
Right.
That we haven't seen before. One of the things I wish I would see, I only know of one other technician getting a Master of Public Health right now. We not only see what's happening as boots on the ground, but we kind of get to see what's coming down the pike in terms of healthcare. What does the healthcare of the future generation look like?
Yeah.
And it's a very scary prospect when you start seeing it in those terms. We're going to be in a pace here soon where we're going to actually have healthcare expenses going up 5 to 10 times the rate of inflation.
Here's the problem I see is that, one, I think that there's, maybe it's too late, you know, but there's got to be different levels of pharmacists. So the I know that community pharmacists are doing more testing and things like that, but there's got to be some levels of pharmacy. In my mind, should be a 2-year degree, basically. Well, first of all, the U.S. system's messed up, where when you go back to college, as I've got 3 kids in college right now, you're repeating the first 2 years that should have happened in a good high school. So there's no reason you should be going back and taking math and history and English and social science and all those things again. That should have happened in high school. And then pharmacy should be like a 2-year degree in the community pharmacy. And with so 4, but minus all the crap of the first 2 years that should have been done in high school, it should be a 2-year career. And maybe PharmD, if they're going to spend more time in the hospital and so on, maybe it's a 3-year degree, you know, take off the 2, 3, maybe another year of residency or something. So maybe it's a 2-year versus 4-year degree. But now, my goodness, I think it's like a seven-year degree out of the gate of high school. I mean,
I think it's 6 to 7.
I thought it was, you know, 6, and I think it's at 7 now, and it's just incredible. And then, all right, so that's one soapbox. Here's the second one. The second one is a lot of pharmacists now losing their jobs, pharmacies closing, things like that. It's not because anything got solved. I mean, the average age of the American male at least has gone down of dying. You know, the it was at 72, now it's at 71 and a half or something. Infant mortality is not much better. Obesity's gone up. Heart disease has gone up. So it's one thing losing a market when something better comes out. So typewriters went away when computers came out. But now, you know, pharmacy's going away, but it hasn't because of prices, but it hasn't gotten better. It's moving because of prices and changing, but not because of improvements, it seems.
Okay. Well, my soapbox will be, I would argue that pharmacists need to become health educators.
Yeah.
And that's a billable profession. You can bill to have diabetes prevention classes as a pharmacist. You can bill to do diabetes self-management education. And what Medicare pays for that is nothing to sneeze at. So, so I think pharmacists really need to, especially in the community, I think we really need to take a look at our neighbors to the north. Let the technicians deal with the stuff behind the counter and let the pharmacists deal with the clinical aspect of the business of pharmacy. Because the pharmacist really is in the ultimate position to actually sit down with patients and be educators and give them a lot more value for their money than what they got out of the doctor's office visit, where they were in the doctor's office for 7 minutes.
Yeah, I think there's something, I think that the key word there is education, because people don't like to leave a doctor's office with education. They want to leave with a prescription of some sort, you know, the magic pill. And is there not enough education out there on the internet and so on? And do people want to get educated? And I think pharmacists are in the right position to do it. But as I have my, you know, third bowl of sugar cereal at night, I know I have enough education to know that's not good for me. So maybe it's the education at the right time and place. And I guess pharmacists can do that. You know, they're more accessible and things like that.
And they're uniquely positioned where they can provide those services, even if they're billing for it at a reasonable rate. You can do diabetes education and bill it out at $75 an hour. And realistically, that's something that should be done. Type 2 diabetes is an entirely reversible condition, and people don't realize that.
You know, back on my question, Adam, I was thinking about, I think that, you know, first of all, I don't know many PharmDs after 7 years that are going to jump back into a master's of public health. And so I think that, you know, that could be a benefit there, that you're not schooled out. And now you see arguably a bigger picture of the healthcare problem than the average, you know, pharmacist coming out of school does now. I think you maybe have the bigger picture.
Looking at the pile of textbooks over there, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I sure as hell ain't going to go back and take classes. And I know someone who's, I know a handful of pharmacists that are maybe attorneys and things like that. But I think that you maybe found the better course of understanding of what's going on with the situation. I don't know. I mean, every pharmacist listening right now would, you know, very well may disagree. But my point is that there's only so much maybe education that somebody wants to get. And you've got quite a original angle now that with your studies in the public health stuff, you know?
It to solve our healthcare problems, we're going to have to get out of our silo. Hospitals operate independent of each other.
They all have their own supply and they're all doing their own thing.
Yeah, they're all doing their own supply and they're all doing their own thing. And none of us are talking to each other. That is how broken our system is. If you go into British Columbia in Canada, a pharmacist can type up on their computer and know every drug you're taking.
Hmm.
And the doctor's office can do exactly the same thing. And not only do they know every drug you're taking, they know how often you're filling it and how compliant you are with your therapy. And we don't have that in this country. We had to build interfaces to actually make our systems talk to each other.
Yeah.
And you've probably, I haven't listened to every episode of your podcast yet. I'm sure you've had.
You've listened to some?
I've listened to some.
Well, oh my goodness. I found someone. You get the you get the golden ticket. I'm about to send you a candy bar or something, Adam.
I'm pre-diabetic. Don't do that.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe I knew that I was off the hook.
The reality is we need some interconnectivity to play the game right and to improve the quality outcomes of this country. But there's a lot that's going to go into to improving the quality and containing the cost. There was another study I read from the German equivalent of the FDA. And the German equivalent of the FDA actually has an extra piece that they do when they approve a drug. In order to not get priced in the same class as a lower cost therapy. So let's say you're developing another one of those me-too SNRIs, serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors.
Yeah.
If you're going to bring out another one of those to the market, you have to prove to me in Germany that it is better than Effexor.
Yes, right.
In order for it to not be priced like Effexor.
Yeah, right.
And if you go to our neighbors to the north, our neighbors to the north actually just took two countries out of their international pricing reference list. The two countries they took out were Switzerland and the United States because it was causing outliers in their data.
Hmm.
But in both cases, they do price controls, one as a quality initiative and the other one as a how much are we paying for drugs relative to other countries?
Mm-hmm.
And they picked five of the lowest cost countries to contain the cost of their medication. And I think we're going to have to start doing that here.
Was your reference on the drug being different because in the U.S., for a new patent to come out, they don't have to prove it's improved. They just have to prove that it's different. Is that where you were getting at, that there's at least improvement in other countries' laws?
Yeah. So in Germany, you have to prove that it's clinically better.
Better, yeah. Where, yeah, here we have the Me Too's of it. It looks different, and I've got a different actor on TV doing it, and I'm gonna slide it in and hopefully we convince some people with our marketing and so on.
Right, because you have bupropion hydrochloride, costs about $100, extended release costs about $100 for a 90-day supply. Somebody came out with bupropion hydrobromide. It costs $13,000 for the same 90-day supply. There is no clinical difference between those two drugs.
Yeah.
And in the last 6 years, 75% of the drugs that have come out in the marketplace have had no clinical benefit improvement over the drugs that already exist that cost a lot less.
Yeah. And I'm part of the problem. I'm sitting here with, like I say, too many bowls of cereal under my belt, and I'm working on that with different plant-based whole food diet and so on. But it's got to come down. It seems that we've got to narrow that gap between heart disease, obesity, you know, cancer, and these high costs of the, and I'm a business owner. I have nothing against profit, but these guys pulling in millions of millions when nothing has changed in the community.
Well, you know what, Mike? In the business of pharmacy, we could make just as much profit in helping patients make the lifestyle changes to get rid of the modifiable risks for disease as we can. And we can make more money doing that than we can by selling prescriptions.
I think you're right, Adam. I always tell my pharmacy that it's like, guys, things might look different. K-pharmacy, any pharmacy might look different, but the holes are still there. When we're the most accessible healthcare agent, and a lot of that's because we're the dumbest maybe and have too much access, but when you've got the life expectancy going down, obesity going up, you know, cancer's going up because of obesity, heart disease, all those kind of things. It's like the problem's still there.
We need to become the profession of lifestyle modification, teaching lifestyle modification. I'm actually going through the training. The CDC offers what's called Prevent T2, which is preventing type 2 diabetes. I'm actually going through the training to deliver the Prevent T2 course. It is a one-year course that's scientifically proven to lower the risk for diabetes. It's insurance reimbursable. It can be delivered inside a pharmacy. It can be delivered inside a doctor's office. It can be delivered inside a clinic. It can be delivered at your local community nonprofit. I'm getting ready, hopefully in January, to deliver it for the first time at a food bank here in Grand Rapids as part of my internship.
Wow.
So we have a lot of power to reverse the modifiable risks for chronic disease. And hypertension, obesity, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, with the exception of type 1, we can't do much about that.
I don't have many complaints of where the pharmacy reimbursement has gone, because when I bought this from my dad 25 years ago, the pharmacy, and now the profit's just about gone, it seems, if not reverse. I knew where it was going, and I knew what wave I was on, and I just decided to ride the wave, you know. So I'm to blame on all this stuff. I saw the wave. I knew the wave was happening. I didn't know finally when the wave would crash like it is now. But now that the wave, it seems, of community pharmacy has kind of crashed, you know, the next, maybe I still have some energy left, and maybe this is my contribution to this next wave coming through with the podcast and so on. But nobody's going to be able to jump that wave or to be on that wave again. It's going to take a different wave of people saying, no, that's not working. We're not going to be able to make one. We're not going to make an impact, but even maybe more important for people in the free market of the U.S., we're not going to be able to make money on this. So now what? Now what problem can we solve to make money on?
The business of pharmacy is going to have to change in this United States to adapt to that reality.
And if not, they're not going to be there.
Right. Independent pharmacies fail for one reason only. They do not adapt to the business climate that they're currently in.
Yeah, that's true. And sometimes they haven't adapted on purpose. You know, like in my case, like, I mean, we've done some things, but not things that on purpose 20 years ago that would extend things for 100 years. I basically knew my lifespan, took the risk that the wave was going to be there long enough. And it seems to be about lasting to that. But if you want to be around a long time, you've got to adapt better than most people have.
Well, and the case in point is, I'm sure the pharmacist that sold the formula for Coca-Cola is still kicking himself if he were still alive today over how much money he could have got off that patent.
So he could have gone that route, you mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you consider Pepsi, Coca-Cola, and Dr. Pepper were all made by pharmacists. Those were all formulations that were done by pharmacists in its history back in the 1800s. We really need to reinvent ourselves again to adapt to this current climate. Current climate being is, in 10 years, it is predicted 1 in 3 adults in the United States will have type 2 diabetes. That road's coming down the pike. And also the other pike that's coming down the road is that 1 in every 6 adults will have cardiovascular disease. Some of those as a result of having type 2 diabetes. And if we can start turning the tide for that now as a pharmacy profession and bill for that, then we have a whole heck of a lot more impact on the public health than, say, a doctor does. Because we can pack 20 people in a room and bill them each $20 for a class.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And here's what I think has to happen for guys like me that have maybe, and I know a lot of listeners are going to say I'm wrong, and they might be right, but
heck, I'm probably wrong too, but you know,
I think somebody who has run a pharmacy for like 5 years, I think that the bitter taste of the PBMs and the pharmacy of how it is now, that takes so much energy and so much fortitude to stand against that, that I almost think that you need somebody who's fresh and who's not dealing with an audit day after day and legal things and you know, having to work through all the smoke and mirrors of the wholesalers and all that. I think it's going to be what I've been seeing the short time I've been doing this show is people coming in through the backside and using the things that are available to them, like the microphone we're talking in and the video screen and the Venmo and all these things to start their businesses from the backside while they have energy, instead of trying to do it from the front end while their energy is depleted, dealing with all the malarkey that's gone on with the PBMs and so on. Now, many people are not as jaded and as depleted of energy as I am to see it change. But personally, like I know right now, if I am going to do something like this to get reinvigorated and come in and help the healthcare system again, I think it's going to be by leaving the pharmacy and coming in through the back door of some other way, because I don't have energy for both.
Community pharmacy is I had to get out of it too, because I was drained every day coming home from work, even only having been a 10-year veteran of the job.
Right. And am I correct in saying that you were more drained than maybe if you had to dig ditches all day? It wasn't a physical drain per se. It was more of a tension, bad attitude, for whose ever attitude it was. But it wasn't a real good physical, you're tired,
no,
right?
No, it was a mental, you're tired. You're mentally done at the end of the day, to the point of, please don't make me answer my cell phone at the end of my day. If people called me after 6 o'clock at night, I didn't answer my phone. Text me. I mean, the reality was I was so sick of talking on the phone. I was so sick of you know, just day-to-day life, that it was just like, there's got to be another way to do this. And we are going to have to get out of our, if we're going to prevent burnout, we're going to have to get out of our boxes.
Yeah.
And reinvent this practice. And I look at public health, there are so many things you can do in public health, that are pharmacy related, that are, I mean, you think about public health news, and public health really is pick random health news of the day. And you'll see it probably when you turn on the 6:30 news tonight, the national news tonight.
Yeah.
You know, you'll get some random, oh, by the way, studies have proven that eating a bar of chocolate a day, it will reduce your cardiovascular risk. Within the practice of pharmacy, there are so many of those pieces of random news bites that we can actually work with the public on. And actually, I would argue that there is a fourth practice of pharmacy outside of hospital, long-term care, and retail. There needs to be a public health pharmacy aspect of our careers. And I don't know what that
looks like. What does that look
like? And I don't know what that looks like yet, but it helps with things like trying to figure out the opioid crisis, the obesity epidemic that we currently have, vaccinations, getting the truth out about vaccinations and actually administering them. I mean, our health department here in Kent County does a pretty kick butt job in administering vaccines, but the reality is that we don't have the same immunity, herd immunity that we used to, or even so much as vaccine development.
Yeah.
Community health education, improving health literacy, getting rid of the health inequities, because as cost of healthcare goes up, people are taking less of their medications. I'm hearing, you know, reading news stories about my son died because he was rationing his insulin. And it was just like, okay, that's a solvable problem in this country.
We're living in the greatest time ever when it comes to getting the word out, like you were talking about. One, we can educate ourselves. We can keep up on things. Two, there's no one in our, there's no producers in our way that say, you can't, I can't do this. I mean, I've got YouTube, I've got a microphone. We both do. And no one's in our way saying, no, we're not going to open the newspaper up to you, or we're not going to open up the radio to you, and so on. One of the things, because of this program, and I was offered a monthly spot on the local TV station, because of this, because I didn't have to go through a producer to get this podcast out, they know you're hungry. And then tomorrow I'm going to be on a morning radio show. And I think part of that's, they know I'm hungry. They see the podcast episode come out and so on. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. What I am trying to say is, somebody listening to this right now, unlike 10 years ago, has everything right now at their disposal to, by tomorrow, to counsel somebody online across the country and help someone doing it and make a buck doing it.
I have a YouTube channel where I actually, it just surprised me the other day. I had produced once a series of 4 videos on pharmacology, and my YouTube channel is affectionately described as drug school, but it teaches pharmacy technicians what they want to know about what it takes to pass the PTCB exam.
Hmm.
You know, so it's a lot easier to watch somebody kind of guide you through it rather than read a textbook. It shocked me the other day. I was looking at my YouTube statistics, and I actually started seeing sources coming from like Blackboard, which is the learning management systems that colleges and universities use. So my YouTube videos are now like starting to reach college students. Their instructor assigned one of my videos.
That's awesome, Adam. Congratulations.
To have that done. So it's, we are in the era of information, and the more information we get out, the better health outcomes we achieve.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then I think people need, you know, obviously people need, they still need someone they can depend on to see if that information is worthy of seeing it.
Absolutely.
Hey, Adam, what does life hold for you? Like, where do you see yourself, like, in 5 years? Do you have any, is this a perfect setting for you, or do you think that you'll be doing something else? And if so, what would that be?
Well, with the prospect of having $47,000 worth of student loans come crashing down on me come August of next year,
because of your
graduate school,
master's,
I'm working on starting a nonprofit called Compassion RX. The first projects that organization will be doing will primarily be dealing with educating the public in reversing modifiable risk factors for chronic disease in Kent County. We are one of the healthiest, Kent County.
Don't put my picture on the front of the brochure as a before picture. If you've ever snapped something at one of our association meetings as I've been shoving loaded potatoes in my mouth, you don't have express written permission from me.
And you don't have express written permission for me for munching down on all the mozzarella sticks we had in those meetings either. So I only have yet to look at my own self in the mirror. But in all reality, we have modifiable risk factors for chronic disease, for cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes. I'm picking on diabetes first because it's the worst problem. And I'm actually going to pick on 2 counties in the same breath. I'm going to pick on Muskegon County and Kent County at the same time. I live in Sparta. It's like right where the two of them meet. Muskegon County has pretty much the worst health statistics of pretty much any county in West Michigan if you take into account their population. They are the highest in poverty, one of the highest in poverty, one of the highest in non-insured people. They have the highest comorbidities of chronic disease. Kent County is almost the exact polar opposite. But even then, the prevalence of disease is getting greater, but the cost of care in Kent County is higher than that of Muskegon County, almost by twofold. I'm going to take this nonprofit. One of its first projects is going to be doing lifestyle modification classes. I'm taking the CDC certification courses to do Prevent T2, and I hope to have that done real soon. I'll actually be done in the middle of October with that, and I'm going to probably give it out as my one of my graduate projects to a food bank here in Kent County, the clients of their food bank, because the most food insecure people actually carry the highest risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, right. Because a lot of it because of the makeup of the food and the low fiber and low veggies and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so they don't have the world's greatest diet. Getting into the places in the community that need the most help, and I am going to be working on getting some grants for that and get that going here real soon.
Are you passionate about that?
I am.
I got to get some passion back. I've been in the business side so long in pharmacy, and I've been so tied up with this negative business flow. And I think there's probably a change coming in my somewhat near future, and I got to get some passion back. I got a lot of passion in other things, but in health, in pharmacy, in the health business, no, not the business, in the health of pharmacy, I don't have a lot of passion.
I'm getting a lot more passionate about the fact that education is going to be the way to get us out of this mess. Every phone call I take on a daily basis from one of my groups is a labor union on the southeast side of the state, and I'll get at least one phone call a week of, I'm in the hospital for diabetic ketoacidosis. My doctor's putting me on insulin. What the heck am I going to do? Mm-hmm. And my job is to help walk them through the process of getting them arranged to get their insulins at little to no cost.
Yeah, right.
Getting diabetes testing supplies because they've never tested their blood sugar ever.
Yeah.
And they didn't realize they were in trouble until they started experiencing these ungodly muscle pains, or they just flat out went into a diabetic coma.
When I hear you talking education, it's like, I'm a damn pharmacist. I mean, for me, education is not the thing. It's the stuff after that. It's the willpower and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of these people that you're talking about probably never even heard of diabetes or know what it's caused from and so on.
Right. And the whole goal of Prevent T2 from the CDC, if they actually go through that whole year of that class, 71% of the people that make and stick to the lifestyle choices that they goal out. So one of the things in type 2 diabetes that they tell you not to do is don't tell people they have to get down to their goal weight. If you told me today I needed to lose 57 pounds, do you think I'm going to lose 57 pounds in the next 4 to 12 weeks? Heck no. One of the things they tell you is to baby step yourself into these lifestyle goals. So in the first 4 months of the program, your goal is to lose 7% of your body weight. Okay. I'm 210 pounds right now, so I'd have to lose 7% of that. Setting yourself up for the goals, getting the lifestyle changes, getting moving. So teaching people how to incorporate activity into their daily lives. And that activity, Mike, might be you going over and doing the dishes yourself instead of having your dishwasher do it.
Wait, is the dishwasher...
Not your wife.
Is it... Okay. All right, I gotta ask that. I wanted to clarify that.
So...
The dishwasher with a small D.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so Adam, it almost sounds like at a certain level, yes, it's education. And like I say, I know it, but I'm in the business. But then I think it goes into such a close education that it's almost coaching.
It is coaching, and that needs to become our business.
Yeah.
So the training that you go through to certify your Prevent T2 program is lifestyle coaching. So you actually take a lifestyle coaching class. It's a 4-week class, and you're teaching people how to do things that change their lifestyle.
And yeah.
Some of the advice that they give you in this Prevent T2 program, I need to take myself, but it's coming from... It says the guy who actually just bought a 90 pack of Totino's pizza rolls at the grocery store this afternoon.
My wife and I had a big argument because I told her that on one of the popsicle boxes, a serving is 3 popsicles. And a lot of the popsicle boxes don't say that, but the one I got, a serving is 3 popsicles. So it's all in the smoke and mirrors, because that could be a 90. That's like 2 servings.
It is. Yeah. And there's like Gatorade is a Gatorade, or even any one of the 20-ounce cola bottles. Pick your manufacturer. Those 20-ounce cola bottles are actually 2.5 servings.
Yeah.
So you actually have to multiply every number on that bottle by 2.5 in order to tell you what your nutrients are from that particular bottle.
You ever go to Michigan's Adventure?
I haven't been in ages.
They've got this kettle corn thing. It's got to be the size of a, not a 40-gallon trash can, but like a, it's like the half the size of one of those white bags you put in your kitchen trash bag.
Okay.
And it's kettle corn. And it says like 390 calories. And I'm like, that's just smelling it would be that amount. I don't know how they're, I don't know why that sign is there. Maybe it's, there's no small print or anything. It must be per serving or something. There's got to be like 100 servings in there.
Oh, I'm sure there are. But of all the snacks you could possibly have, that's actually one of the better ones at Michigan's Adventures.
I suppose.
So.
Yeah, but that coaching. Yeah, the coaching. I need like, you know, I mean, I don't know. Like at night, I need like half servant, half coach. So when I say go get me cereal, they know to get the almond milk and the, you know, go lean versus the cornflakes and the milk and so on.
Try this at night. I actually started doing this to get myself off of eating, like, you know, smashing down 3 Kit Kats at the end of the day.
We're assuming that's a goal we don't want to have.
That's a goal you don't want to have. I took a half a cup of frozen berries, frozen mixed berries, so it's strawberries, blueberries, blackberries, and raspberries in a mix that I bought as a frozen medley out of the freezer section at the grocery store. And I mix it with 8 ounces of milk. And I whiz that up in a personal blender, and it kind of makes like a smoothie. It's a sweet treat that you can have at the end of a day. It feels like you had something guilty.
Yeah, that's the thing.
But it's by far better for you than going and having the Frosted Flakes with a half a gallon of whole milk in them. Or
I think it's fun to feel a little guilty. If you got to feel a little bit like a glutton afterwards, or else you don't feel like you've, you know, done anything. Yeah.
The glass is a pain in the neck to wash the next day, but
so Adam, would you, as you look at the Masters of Public Health, do you always see yourself like, I don't know, maybe I'm lazy and I've taught too many new employees and so on, but if I had an interest in that, and I guess the good Lord gives everybody different talents and desires, if I did something like that, I think mine would be more on the administration side, where I'm like setting up, you know, setting up the schedule and marketing and things like that. Do you like the actual patient? Do you actually like talking to people?
Here's the fun about the public health program. You can do anything with that degree you can think of. So when we graduate with 5 competencies. So one of them is we use evidence-based decision making. So we take a look at data, or we take a look at an epidemiological study or whatever have you. We look at the data, determine the need. Then we plan for a program. We implement and educate. And then we use systems-based thinking, which means we actually take a look at what is going on in the community as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Where does my particular piece of that public health system fit within that overall system? You can do a lot. One of the jobs that is available for a master of public health is a sanitarian at the public health department. I learned what a sanitarian does. Not my style of work. Sanitarians go into restaurants. They do the restaurant inspections to make sure that the food you eat in a restaurant is safe. They go out and do septic certifications.
Yeah.
That's the part of the job that got me that I was not prepared to do.
Well, part of the whole thing, as you mentioned a couple times, is keeping the whole damn thing together with communication. And that's, you know, just looking at the whole piece and keeping people on the same page has got to be a big part of it, too.
You learn very quickly in this program. In a master of public health program, you learn very quickly how broken the system is.
On that question, Adam, do you see yourself working, being with patients for another 5-10 years, or do you see yourself in administration?
I see myself doing a little bit of both. I see myself probably keeping the job I have, and I'm probably going to be tacking on the educational component and doing the Prevent T2 classes on the side. I'll have my main pharmacy job, but as a side hustle, I'll be doing health education.
Yeah, that's cool. How was your more than a dabble, but in the state association from a few years ago when you did some work with the state association as far as presenting or trying to put forward motions and so on. Was that good for you, or did you sour on any of that with the state? Are you still involved with the state in that regard through the Kent County Association and then into the Michigan Pharmacy Association? I'm just asking because those who are listening, you know, there's not enough involvement there. And so what was your take on all of that?
With the local association, I was becoming a bit jaded, but we've had a leadership change since then. So
yeah, I saw some new ones.
I'm still serving on two boards. I'm the technician liaison for the Consultants and Specialty Pharmacists of Michigan, which is, as Larry Wagenknecht of the Michigan Pharmacists Association calls it, that's the island misfit pharmacists. So that's that deals with compounding and consulting and nuclear and managed care, which is where I work now. The outskirts of pharmacy or the not your average pharmacist land.
Sure.
And then I'm also a voting member of the Michigan Society of Pharmacy Technicians. I'm actually, my term ends next year, and I'll probably be president of that board.
Well, congratulations. How often are you making the, hour and 15-minute trip down to Lansing?
When you're on an MPA board, each meet quarterly, so once every 3 months. Generally speaking, you can do them by phone. Michigan's not exactly a small state geographically.
Yeah, I was going to say by phone or video or something like that now.
So like one of the CSPM members is in the Upper Peninsula. So I do a lot of them by phone or video chat, just like we're having conversation here.
Yeah, right.
We have that same ability at the Michigan Pharmacists Association to join our meetings that way. So
oh, that's good.
If I have a board meeting, frequently what I'll do is I'll just drag my laptop into work and log on to the Wi-Fi at work and have my meeting over the video conference.
And some people are there in person.
And some people are there in person.
And then you're represented being on the wall.
Yeah, and then I get to be the voice of God on the speaker system in the room too.
Oh, because yeah.
When I'm speaking on my mic, there's speakers in their conference room that.
You should dress up funny like the guy on the what was that, Heaven's Gate or something? Remember that thing? Do you remember that years ago, that crazy guy that would get up there? He had like, that was the one where like, I don't know what, 39 people took their life or something and were going to go join the UFO or something.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
He was always on the video conference like that. So,
oh, yeah.
But he always had like a robe on or something. Well, I'm glad they're using that because I enjoyed my year or so going down to when I was on the marketing board. The state's got just a ton of stuff that you can lend to, and it's great to meet people and so on. But I would go down for a year or so, but then it just got to be, or maybe a couple of years, but then it got to be a lot. But now with video, that would be a good way to do it.
It is. It does reduce that time commitment, especially with the Michigan Society of Pharmacy Technicians. Our board meetings are not in Lansing. Our board meetings are in Flint. And heaven help you if I'm driving to Flint 4 times a year.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's a hike and a half.
Yeah.
And it's going to be fun enough that I have to drive to Flint in a couple of weeks, but I'm presenting a continuing education for the Michigan Pharmacy. We do a 5 live event for pharmacy technicians every year.
Why do they do Flint for the techs?
At the time when I joined the board, 4 out of the 7 board members either worked for Diplomat, Mott Community College, or Genesis, yeah, or McLaren, and so they were already in that particular neighborhood, so that was just where the meetings were held.
I don't know anything about Flint, but I do know that Diplomat's there, right? That's their headquarters now?
Diplomat has their headquarters there.
Gotta be careful of their suspensions are mixing up, though, with the water.
Oh.
Hopefully they're using purified...
Yeah, they have their own system, their own water system, so their facility is absolutely huge.
I forget why they chose Flint again. Was that because of tax things?
Tax cut. They took over an old GM plant.
Oh, that's good. Good for them.
They consolidated all of their pharmacy operations out of that one facility.
Oh, that's good.
Phil and Jen Hagerman are from that area, so.
Gotcha.
So that's why Flint got chosen, but they essentially have 3/4 of an old GM plant that they operate. They lease the other quarter of that to McLaren Health, who operates their laboratory services out of that.
Oh, that's
that
interesting.
Building. So,
huh, that's cool.
So they have quite a uh, quite the operation over there.
Yeah. You've probably got the tour over there and that stuff when you've been there to Flint.
Yeah, I got the tour of their facility. It's absolutely gargantuan. And there is a whole subset of technicians there that do essentially half of what my job is currently in managed care, where they do the prior authorizations and...
Oh, yeah, because they're the specialty pharmacy.
They're the specialty pharmacy. So they do the copay assistance and signing patients up for copay assistance and all that fun stuff. They have an entire department of technicians that does that. So They also have an entire department of nurses, too. I never even realized that in specialty pharmacy they have nurses working there that do clinic phone calls. So
Big operations.
So it's a huge operation.
My daughter got married in North Carolina a few weeks ago, and we were driving home, and I think I was going through Columbus, maybe, but I think that's where, and there's this huge building of Cover My Meds, which for those not familiar, it's a, I think the business is just based on getting prior authorizations for, you know, pharmacy people, but they got this humongous building, and it's like, damn, that's a, talk about red tape. There's so much red tape, they were able to tape stories together to get this huge building for that.
Well, in 2 years' time, Medicare is actually going to require all prior authorizations for Medicare Part D to become electronic. Cover My Meds is essentially your one-stop shop for doing that. You send an electronic prior authorization off to the doctor's office, and they fill out their electronic PA, and then they send that electronically to the insurance company with the entire goal of reducing the amount of time it takes to do a PA from 72 hours to 24.
You know, I... Here I am in the business a couple years ago, and I was trying to get this medicine, and we sent a, it was for me, I think, might have been for one of my kids, but we sent a PA in, and it was denied. And so I called the doctor up, and I'm like, look, it's denied. We got to change it to something else. She said, no, we just need a double PA or something. I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, oh, that's like, the first one they always deny, and the second one, that's where you have to go. You have to get a second deny. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I've been in this business, you know, and now it's gone from, you know, not only it's like there's a PA, but then there's really the PA, you know, and it's like, what a mess.
If you get a letter of denial, though, and you make less than 500% of the federal poverty level, in 90% of those cases, the drug company will just ship you the drug if it's a brand name drug.
If you make less than
500% of the federal poverty level. Now, Mike,
500%.
Now, Mike, given the fact that I know how many kids you have, 500% of the federal poverty level for you is probably like $300,000+.
Oh, is the poverty level switch between how many kids you have?
Yes.
Maybe I'm impoverished.
Yes.
I've got 10 children, so maybe I'm impoverished. And I decided I'm not going to have any more, I think. I think 10's it.
I don't think your wife would let you have any more.
I don't think so. Our youngest is 8, I think. So we're actually getting a dog tomorrow in Lansing, a new puppy. And she says, well, are you ready for it? And I'm like, I'm not doing that night thing. She's like, no, I'm signed. This is mine. So we switched from humans to animals, at least.
Yeah, mine have always been animals. So
yeah, that's probably that might be a better that might be a no. I'll you know,
I don't have to put them both through good. College.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Yeah, we've got 3 done with college and 3 in college, and then another 4 more coming up. Geez, that's a whole nother story of the college bubble and stuff. So thankfully we have a great, you know, community college in town here.
Yeah. And I actually got my start in community college. So
it's a great way to go. And not being a research college, you get people there that are there that want to teach.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, versus having their head in the research and having the student teachers doing the thing or whatever.
What struck me was the relationship going through grad school now, is the relationship I have with my grad school professors versus what I, the relationship I had with my undergrad professors is significantly different. When I'm going through my master of public health, first off, with the exception of, I think, maybe two or three of them in the program, there's six professors that teach the program, with the exception of three or four of them. So about half of them make you use their doctor salutation. The other half are like, just call me Amy.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and they're like, right. So I have like Amy, Vivian, Dr. McMorrow, Dr. Vamos.
Point out the difference, Adam, between that and the community college, because some of them you have a closer relationship with, demonstrated by calling them by their first name and so on, is more of a friendly.
They see you as becoming professional equals.
Yeah, right.
Rather than I lord over you with my 6 degrees higher than you have.
Yeah.
That, and you're not one of, and I know this because at post-secondary level, I actually teach for a community college and I also teach for a university.
Oh, okay.
I teach freshman level classes because they don't require my master's. If I have my full teaching load at both colleges at any one given time, I have 150 students.
Oh, yeah. So just the pure numbers.
So just sheer number volume alone of the number of students I'm working with is pure insanity.
Yeah, just the numbers are too high.
Yeah. And when you're a grad student, you're one of, I think in my grad, my cohort, we have 19.
Gotcha.
So in my particular master's program, there are 19 students rolling through the what will become the second year. And I haven't met the new first year cohort yet.
And the teachers know you're more interested too. You're not taking it just out of duty and so on.
A lot of the projects that you get to work on are projects which you actually have a vested interest in.
Yeah, right.
Our projects kind of take on and morph into what we plan on doing after graduation.
Yeah, right.
But you have a lot more leeway to it. So, for example, I just got done writing, doing a grant writing class. That was my second half of my semester, summer semester, was grant writing. And I wrote a grant for a nonprofit pharmacy in Grand Rapids. We got done to the end of the project, and she said, if you make a couple of few tweaks to this, you actually probably have a grant that actually has a chance of getting funded. If you work on a project that you're passionate about when you're writing it,
yeah,
writing is a lot easier. When you're writing in undergrad school, I took women in developing countries. I couldn't have given two craps about what anything I wrote in that class was about.
Yeah, I remember one time I can't say I necessarily ever cheated in college, but I had one time where I had to write about a concert I went to. I guess it was cheating. I had to write about a concert I went to and I didn't go. And so I had to, you know, make it up. And I said how the guy in front of me kept moving back and forth, so I couldn't get a good view of the stage and all that kind of stuff. But it was I shouldn't have done it, but that's water over the dam. I'm going to stick with that story and you stick with your $70,000 story.
All right. Sounds good.
So I'll leave. Hey, Adam, great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Mike. I appreciate you having
me. Yeah, my pleasure. Best wishes to you. I know people are going to be inspired by what they hear. If they want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
So I have a website called mydrugschool.com, mydrugschool.com. There is a contact me. They can get a hold of me. It goes to my personal email. That would be the easiest way to get a hold of me. If anyone's in an employer group and they want me to lower their drug spend, healthplanadvocate.com is where I work. So
nice. Hey, save some potato skins for me and I'll to get down to the meeting one of these months.
Absolutely. September 11th, they're doing a diabetes one.
Oh, all right. September 11th. All right. I'll write that down. Wait, is that one where you have to learn? I just want one where we're going to eat and eat and go over agendas that are like 10 years old that we don't change. That's the one I want to go to.
With Lisa as board president, I don't know if there's going to be too many more of those. So.
Oh, geez. Well, I'm out then. All right, Adam. Take care.
Will do. Thanks, Mike.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.